Accession number 29075, reel 12.
With reel 12. The period 82 to 85 that I was in India, it was a very interesting time to be there, because where India had over the years been a bit of a backwater, it was now really coming through quite strongly, both politically and commercially, but especially politically. Mrs. Gandhi was really at the height of her powers. Democracy had been restored after the emergency of the late 70s. She was the chairman of the non-aligned movement of countries that were aligned to neither East nor West, which was an organisation of which the West as a whole was pretty suspicious. But nevertheless, it gave her a great deal of political clout in the world. Not long after we got there, two or three months later, the Asian Games were held in India and were a significant success organisationally and as a sporting event. Was typical of the way that India and the Indians were gaining confidence. Then in 83, in the autumn of 83, there was a Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting which was held in Delhi. And that, as usual, involved a state visit by the Queen, which took place beforehand. And that was a very good time for Anglo-Indian relations. Because there were these contacts, there was then so much more understanding, and Mrs. Thatcher came out, obviously, for the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. And I met her and had a particular session with her. Actually, it was about the Sea King deal. And then I saw, during the meeting, I saw her at lunchtime each day. And she very quickly achieved a sympathetic understanding of where India was coming from. She didn't necessarily like or agree with everything she saw, but she achieved an understanding that was not there, and generally was not there in much of the defence establishment, and I suspect in the Foreign Office as well, before that visit. It was a very useful time. And of course, the Indian senior people all relished the chance of meeting the Queen and that sort of thing. For myself, I was very interested to meet Mother Teresa, who was awarded an Order of Merit and came to the presidential palace where the Queen was staying, and which is the old viceregal lodge which Lutyens had designed. And Mother Teresa was waiting outside for a while before going in. She was very quiet person, and there were two or three of us were gently talking to her. She was not, she was, I think, a little in awe of the occasion, but it was interesting to have seen her. She was so tiny, which was the thing that had was surprised me. Of course, as well as it were, Queen state visits, the Indian Navy and the RN exchange state visits by their chiefs of naval staff. And after I had been out there about 8-9 months, I came over with the Indian chief of naval staff, who was called Admiral Dawson, Stan Dawson, for his state visit to the RN, which was a very interesting experience, and where he was able to pick up a lot of direct information about the Falklands campaign, which had taken place the previous year, and as well talk through problems that there were, and suddenly one of those invaluable opportunities occurred. Every cloud has its silver lining. HMS Ambuscade, a Type 21 frigate, collided in the Arabian Sea with an American cruiser while they were doing close quarters manoeuvring. And she had made really quite a mess of the front, 10, 12 feet of her bow. And this occurred while Admiral Dawson was in London. And the first Sea Lord then was Admiral Fieldhouse. And he immediately got on to Stan Dawson, who said, "We will give all possible help." And so the Ambuscade, then under her own power, went to Bombay, and she was accepted there and was docked down, and the ship's company were put ashore to live in a hotel, and she was there for about 8 or 9 weeks, during which time, of course, she was the most marvellous ship visit. Felt very, very sad for the captain of the ship and so on. But as I say, every cloud has its silver lining. And I do wonder whether, if that incident had occurred at sea when Stan Dawson was at home in Delhi, whether he'd have been able to get away with the response that he gave so generously, willingly and happily when he was asked if the Indian Navy would be able to help. I think that he'd have found himself surrounded by political influences which would have made it more difficult for him. Anyway, it all happened, and it was a very good thing. And then, about a year later, Admiral Fieldhouse and his wife came out to India, and we, of course, accompanied them around on their trip, and which was very interesting, and it was the first time I'd actually got on board the Godavari, this new stretch Leander that I was talking about earlier, which was very interesting to see. I had heard quite a lot about her, and I'd seen her alongside, but I hadn't actually been on board, so that was good. The last few months of my time in India were a time of some nervousness, because Mrs. Gandhi was assassinated in November 1984. And as luck or whatever would have it, on the day that she was assassinated, my wife and I were in a small village, really, on the east coast, called Gopalpur on Sea, where, incidentally, Mrs. Gandhi had been the day before opening a new defence establishment, about which I actually knew nothing. I was there because I was on my way up from a previous visit to Madras and Hyderabad, and we were going on to meet up with Princess Anne, who was then going on a Save the Children Fund visit using my car, and I was to meet her in Orissa. And we decided to stay in Gopalpur on Sea, and we were there when this was announced on the BBC. And everywhere, of course, went into a deep gloom. Now, people forget that within the Indian PR system, the Brits were being blamed for her assassination, because we were allowing dissident Sikhs to live in London and preach their dissent from London as a secure base. And we had been asked on a number of occasions to deal with them. In a way, it's a mirror image of where we are at the moment with many Muslims. But in the June of 1984, there had been the raid by the British Army, by the Indian Army, on the Golden Temple in Amritsar, for which the Sikh Sikhs, by and large, certainly the dissident Sikhs, were never going to forgive Mrs. Gandhi. And, of course, a Sikh member of her guard was who shot her. And there had been quite a build-up of this complaint. It had been much in the press, this business about the British government not helping with the Sikh problem. And I could see that people would have known that we were staying where we were. So I reckon that the best thing to do was to go out and join everybody. The whole village went on padayatra, as they call it, which is really a slow perambulation round and round and round. And in this case, very mournful. They can have joyful padayatra, but not that one. But anyway, there was no problem for us. And but it was a very interesting chance to see the ordinary Indian people, and firstly their pride and their sorrow. It was a very, very moving experience. My wife had been able to come with me on several trips. There was a ration we were allowed. I think she was allowed to do 3 trips a year with me. So that enabled her to see much of India. And our children came out in the school holidays. And it was a very valuable time for us as a family. I was very fortunate to get it. I thought a few words about the people who are at the top of the Indian Navy while I was out there. The chief of the naval staff was Admiral Dawson, who was a former Royal Indian Navy officer who had served through the Second World War and had served in sloops or frigates or something out in the Indian Ocean, who was emotionally very pro the RN, but then very pro the RN, but rather anti-British in some ways. But you can be that. You can be pro RN and not very much in favour of Britain. He was really, I think, rather he minded the shop for a while. He had taken over from a man who'd apparently been a very strong character and probably done too much. And Stan Dawson was a consolidator. But the Indian Navy certainly prospered under his leadership. And he certainly had sort of good personal leadership qualities. But he wasn't a very decisive person. His successor was Admiral Taliani, Ram Taliani, who was an aviator, had his early aviating experience with the RM. He'd trained with the RM initially as a cadet and then as a midshipman, had done his junior officer's courses here in this country, and he eventually returned to India as a qualified pilot. He was a very strong character and knew just what he wanted for the Indian Navy and for its air arm. And at the same time, he was an engaging man. I have a very, very great respect for him. And he'd had his disappointments and unhappinesses in life. His wife had died, but he remarried while we were out there. And he gave the Indian Navy a strong lead. He was the CNS who decided to buy the Hermes and then drove the Hermes project through. And he set the operational standards that he wanted the Sea Harriers to deliver. The other person who set those standards as well was a vice admiral, or he became a vice admiral, called Subhash Chopra, who was a very fine character, a couple of years older than me, and he had been the Assistant Chief of Naval Staff, Air, and then he went down to become the Flag Officer, Goa, and he eventually became a seagoing admiral and the commander of the Eastern Fleet. And he was at Goa when the Sea Harriers arrived out there, and he allowed them time to settle in, and then he started to set the standards that were really, really required. There was a very astute, clever man called Gulu Hirunandani, who became the vice chief of the naval staff while I was out there. He also later became the commander-in-chief south. And this generation had been trained initially in the RN. And this was not necessarily an experience from which we could claim a great deal of credit. Just because they'd been trained by us didn't mean to say they liked us. And Hirunandani was a distinct case of that. I don't think he did like the RN. I don't think he did like the Brits. And when I know many of his contemporaries, and I don't think he was terribly well treated by them when he was here. And this was the case with many of them. One couldn't make assumptions that the senior people in the Indian Navy would be grateful to the RN, or to me, for what the RN had delivered to them. In many ways they were, and I saw Hirunandani just a few months ago, and very, very friendly. And when I was in my next job in London, I saw him several times when he came, and he was wanting to know how we organise things and so on. He was actually an impressive intellect, but one of whom to be a bit wary. Another one in the same mould, I would say, was Vice Admiral Nayar, who was the Commander-in-Chief South and the Vice Chief as well during my time out there. He was a very well-read and astute man. Ever since he had been a midshipman here, every week he had received his copy of The Economist, very well informed. It was an astute thing to have done. But he was not necessarily a friend of Britain, but at least we were able to understand each other. We had we knew each other on level terms, so to speak.
Was there an assumption in the Royal Navy that the Indian Navy and other Commonwealth navies would be viewing the Royal Navy and Britain sympathetically?
Oh yes, it was a fairly general arrogant and condescending view, which also applied in the Foreign Office. My Foreign Office briefings were telling me, oh, it'd be fine because all these senior people had been brought up in the RN. Well, I kept my own counsel on that, because by the time I got out there, there was only one still serving in the Indian Navy who had been in my term. And then I discovered there was another, but the first one was a very nice Sikh, and there was no problem there. And then the Chief of Staff, who was a Rear Admiral in Bombay, turned out to have been in my term. He suddenly sort of popped up from nowhere, and he's a very good friend in personal terms, but he's pro-Indian, he's not pro-Brit. I think it's very easy, or it was then, easy for us to make assumptions about people's reactions to ourselves merely because they know us well. It may be that they know us too well for our good. But they were an interesting bunch. I had a very nice opposite number in London, the Indian naval advisor, Santosh Gupta, an aviator, a brave aviator who won their equivalent of a DSO in the war with Pakistan in 1971. He and I, whenever we did see each other and got together, got on very well, and had a clear understanding of the other's difficulties, let's put it that way. And the Director of Naval Intelligence, who inevitably, as usual, superintended the attachés in Delhi, had two or three while I was out there, but the key one was a Commodore Shekhawat, who subsequently became an admiral and the chief of the naval staff, a submariner. And he knew and understood us very well. He has an English brother-in-law. He'd not been trained in the RN, really, but he'd come over to train as a submariner when they were hoping, and the RN was hoping, that the Indian Navy would buy some Oberon-class submarines from us. And then suddenly the choppers were put on that by Harold Wilson. And the Indians all went home. Their next stop was Moscow, where they got trained to run Russian submarines, which is what they have had ever since. There have not been any RN submarines in the Indian Navy. About which he certainly felt a bit rather bitter about the way they had been treated, not that it was in any way visited upon me, and had very cordial relations when I was in India. I went back to India this year, 2006, for the first time for 21 years, and he was one of several people whom I saw, and he was as friendly as ever, but no reference was made to that matter. But at the time I was out there, I realised that quite clearly, that he had this reservation. And I think it's always worth being sensitive enough to, and it is important as an attaché or an advisor, to be able to pick up these sniffs in the wind. But India was a very satisfying job to do. One was entirely on one's own. I didn't have any assistance. I had a half of a civilian girl secretary. And then there was an assistant defence attaché who was a wing commander whom one could use if one wanted. And there was an absolutely superb warrant officer from the Pay Corps. And a superb RAF corporal. And then at my own level, there was a soldier and an airman as well. We were a good little team, and we could do things for each other. But basically, one was on one's tod out there. And it became very satisfying. It was hard work, because there was a lot to do across the desk. And at the same time, one had to do the social things and do the diplomatic round in the evenings and so on. But it was good fun, a great experience, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
If you could explain what happened when you returned from India.
Yes, when I came back from India, I was due for quite a slice of leave, because actually I had not had any home leave at all while I was out there, for a variety of reasons. And I was in the summer of 1985, I was asked to undertake a study for the Naval Secretary, who was concerned about one particular aspect of captain appointing in times of emergency, and whether he believed or had been told that there was a shortage of seamen captains for it. Anyway, my study demonstrated to him that there was no such shortage at all. The only thing was to use the captains of the other branches to fulfil jobs which might have been allocated to seamen but didn't particularly require a seaman's that's even to fill them. And then in the October of that year, October 1985, I took up a job in London in the Ministry of Defence, but working in the old Admiralty building, actually in the south side of Admiralty Arch, and I was the Director of Naval Service Conditions. What's that, people always ask? Well, it was something like the trade union representative for the whole of the Navy. It was a job where one was required to be interested in practically everything was going on, and to try and put forward the man and his views. There were certain things that particularly went with the responsibility of all the family support, family and personal service. I have a section all of the delivery of that, of course, was done down at the home ports, particularly Portsmouth and Devonport, but also a little in Rosyth. But we monitored the way the ships were being used, and just occasionally we spotted that a ship was getting more than its fair share of sea time or something, or that in fact, well, it may be home based, it had actually been doing Monday to Friday running on some very boring trial for month after month after month, and it would then be for us to get on to the usually the fleet programmers to draw attention to the, and usually they responded, it was something that had slipped past them. So it was a sort of monitoring of the operational impact upon individuals. And obviously one tried to, since ships were supposed to be away for only 9 months at the time, one did monitor that was what they were, or if it wasn't going to be that, the right explanations were being offered so that everybody, the families as well as the sailors themselves, understood. I had a ceremonial section, so to speak, and things like royal weddings and official memorial services and that sort of thing. We were also responsible for the state funerals, flags, the licenses to fly the blue ensign, all sorts. It's a real old rag bag, it was, really. And then I was also much concerned, or became in my time much concerned, with the development of personal service documentation. The service certificate that a sailor has, or had, had been the same for 100-something years. And it involved, it was manpower intensive, it was all done with a quill pen sort of thing. And we were coming into the computer age. Let's, you know, use it properly. There was an onboard administration, a computer system, which was being developed called OASIS, and I was much involved there in what we wanted it to deliver and how we wanted to deliver it, and to do it in the easiest way possible, because the Navy's record in administrative computers with regard to pay was not awfully good. We had a computer to do the pay, but it required more men to support the system than it had when it was all done by quill pen. So one was trying to learn that lesson. Then I had an entirely separate department which did the inter-service pay negotiations and so on. I had a deputy director, brackets pay, and then he, under him, had a team of four. And
they did all the things to do with pay and allowances. And yes, they used to read across to the rest of us, but it was a lot of it was very much self-contained. But it was a difficult time.